Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available. Our long national nightmare is over. All you have to do to order it is go to the Commentary Track website, thecommentarytrack.com, go to the video page, and it's the very first video there. Just click on Add to Cart, and voila, it will be yours. I mean, after you go to the PayPal and pay for it. It's merely $20, free postage. Who could ask for anything more? Hope you'll enjoy it. Hope you'll order it now. Or wait a little bit and order it right after you listen to this nice episode of the Commentary Track.
The Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of the Commentary Track, brought to you by Chocolate Cookies with White Stuff in the Middle. I'm your blonde, blue-eyed host, Frank Thompson. We have a good one for you today. And it's a little off the beaten track because it only barely concerns movies at all. I realize Commentary Track is a movie-related podcast, but this one I could not resist. I am talking with David Pollack, who is the author of a new book on Bob and Ray. Bob and Ray, keener than most persons. I love Bob and Ray. They are my comedy heroes, and I listen to them a lot. And so when I read this terrific book, I immediately contacted the publisher and asked to be put in touch with the author. And Bob's your uncle. There we are. I went over to his house and had a wonderful chat. And he knows even more about Bob and Ray than I do. And that's not hard because I don't know all that much about him. Although I can do every one of their routines by heart. At least some of them. This is a really fun interview. And David's a really interesting guy, too. I never met him before this interview, but also is an incredibly successful TV writer, and he wrote for MASH and The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and wrote for Jack Benny's nightclub act, wrote for The Carol Burnett Show, Don Rickles Show, All in the Family, Frasier, Cheers. This is an accomplished guy and a fun guy to talk to. So, even though this is only kind of movie-related, we do talk about Bob and Ray's movie appearances. I do hope that you'll enjoy this episode of the Commentary Track devoted to the great Bob and Ray. See you on the other side. How did you get interested in Bob and Ray? Did you know them both?
I knew neither of them. As a kid, tune in one morning. I think I was in the eighth grade, and I heard them on NBC, and they just were so different. And, sort of stuck. You know, I was hooked.
And so you were just a fan for a long time?
I was a fan all through high school and college. And then ultimately got into the business as a comedy writer. And I had a couple of times gone and watched them when I was in New York, watched them broadcast. So although I had met them, you know, it was basically just a handshake and a hello, you know.
Yeah.
And that was all.
I've always been curious about that because especially in the early recordings, the late 40s, the 50s, you could always hear somebody laughing in the background, or not always, but a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, did they just have people sitting around the studio, or was there any kind of formal audience situation ever?
Well, most of all of their series were without a formal studio audience. There were a couple of exceptions. A 15-minute show they did for Colgate on NBC in 1952 and 53, they did use a studio audience, and there were laughs there. And then the major portion of the later NPR series on National Public Radio, those were taped in front of a studio audience. But I think what you're referring to is when they started in Boston and in other places, people just working in the building would stop by. The engineers and sound guys sometimes would laugh. In Boston, a couple of people, college students, often would come by, and their laughter sort of served as an invitation for others to stop by. I think ultimately the station did set up chairs for them, but it was not a very formalized studio audience.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that really sweet little moment when obviously Ray's wife is there with Ray Jr., and Ray Jr. walks up to them during the show and starts talking to Ray. Do you remember that? He just comes up. He must be like 2 years old or something. He says, "Hi, my daddy."
I do remember hearing
throughout that entire episode, you can hear the laughter, but it's clearly only of three or four people, but it's just people sitting around. Yeah. So I've always wondered about that.
I know when they did their TV series, Bob said that, and the shows came on, I think, around 7:15 at night. So often people leaving the building would stop just in the sound lock between the corridor and the studio and between those two sets of doors and just stand there watching the show. And they would often laugh. And it was all very informal.
There was especially in the early 50s, it was a very informal time for broadcasting, wasn't it? Because there was... I knew a man named Louis Gomovitz who directed every episode of Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. Mm-hmm. And he said it was exactly like that almost throughout their run, that people would just come in. It was a tiny, tiny studio, much smaller than this room we're in. But always there would be 8 or 10 people just standing there watching.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Well,
particularly with television, because it was just feeling its way. So it was very informal and often sometimes a little ragged.
Oh, sure. And that's what it always strikes me with Bob and Ray is when you listen to their very early stuff, they're clearly improvising a whole lot. And they're much wackier than they would become. They finally become very dry and understated, and that's what we think of as Bob and Ray.
Yes.
But they were cut-ups.
Exactly. And I sort of explain that in the book. You know, all they ever wanted to be was announcers. You know, they sort of came of age at the same time radio did, so they were sort of caught up in it. This is totally independent of each other. They'd never met until after the war when they were... you know, found themselves working on the same shift at this station, WHDH in Boston. So radio is all they, you know, was sort of the driving force in their lives. It was the new entertainment. And all they wanted to be were announcers. In those days, announcers were, you know, wore tuxedos and had these kind of deep, golden-throated voices. And... Ray ends up doing newscasts on Bob's early morning record show on the station, a show called Sunny Side Up. And after the conclusion of the newscast, would hang around and they would just kibitz. And it sort of caught on. And as I wrote in the book, with the approval of management, approval being nobody told them to stop, they kept doing it. And then when the station, and it really caught on, when the station later then got the rights to the Boston Red Sox and Boston Braves baseball games, they wanted a pregame show, and so they put the two together for just a 20-minute show. And they never really talked about baseball. They just, filled the time with the only thing they knew, which was spoofing then current radio shows of the era. And it was all spontaneous. It was just on the fly. Sometimes they'd bail out of a sketch in the middle of it. The spontaneity of it was sort of the driving force of it in a way. And because it was so obvious that we were just making it up, the audience was sort of with them. They had all these other duties at the station, like newscasts and the men on the street shows and, doing dance remotes from, these terrible dives of in bad neighborhoods of Boston. There was no time to write material. There wasn't even time to steal it. So everything was ad-libbed. And as you say, in contrast to what would later happen, where their characters would sort of take over, Bob and Ray, as themselves, were sort of the driving force. They were zany. They were madcap. I think you said antic.
They break themselves up a lot. Which you almost never hear. Sometimes yes. Bob breaks up a little bit.
Yeah.
Later on.
They talked. Sometimes they just talked over each other, and they. But it ultimately evolved, and when they got to the network, as you point out, the shows were a lot more disciplined.
Yeah. I know that the guys from the Firesign Theater were very influenced by them, and I got to think that it's the early stuff that really influenced them, because that's when there was a touch of the surreal to what they were doing. I was listening to one driving over today. I think it was Life and Loves of Linda Lovely. Mm-hmm. And
this is from the Boston years?
Yeah, this mm-hmm. is from 49, because mm-hmm. they actually say at one point, oh, it's almost 1950, so I know I know the year.
Yeah.
But they start talking with one of the characters about how he's not doing his accent right. And mm-hmm. they say, you really, if you're going to play a tough guy, you really should do it this way. And
yeah.
and he tries a couple of different voices. And and actually, Ray takes over as the voice from Bob.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of stuff that you really didn't hear them do
Well,
later on much.
That's true. Occasionally, they were always willing to poke fun at themselves.
Sure.
If one had a cold, they would be the first to remark about how crazy it is that all these other characters have a cold. And, if you know all the characters they did, the fact that their explanation for the fact that the two female characters, like Natalie Attired mm-hmm. and Mary Magoon, that Mary Magoon was playing Natalie Attired.
Yes. Similarly, Webley Webster plays Calvin Hugeman.
And there's also a lot of inconsistencies. Over the years, names changed because, it was not only were they on the fly on the air, but off the air, too. I mean, nobody kept records. Nobody kept charts on this stuff. So,
The timeline was very hard to keep track of, I guess. Now, when did you decide that you wanted to start writing about them?
It just sort of evolved. There was I had known for many years a fellow writer who ultimately wrote for Bob and Ray for many years named Tom Cook. He wrote for them actually on and off for about 33 years. And we were just sort of casual friends. We'd cross paths every now and then. And occasionally we would, I would always be asking about, what are you writing now, or, how is it going? And he said, you ought to write a book for them. And I said, well, Tom, a book about them. And I said, Tom, well, you're the one who should do it. And that sort of went on off and on over the years. And then it just evolved. There was another fellow by the name of Dan Gillespie who had contacted Tom, and he was thinking of writing a book and asked me to help him. He ultimately decided that he didn't have the time to give it all the hours that the project deserved, so I ended up doing it. And that, not a very interesting story, but that's how it happened.
And this is probably after Ray had passed away.
Oh, yes, definitely. Although the conversations between Tom and I went on you know, over a lot of years, but not necessarily often. I mean, years would go by, we'd never even see each other. It was just sort of almost a joke in a way. I was never that really anxious to do it initially because I just assumed that they probably didn't want a biography for whatever reason. You know, they never were that really pushy about promoting themselves. Yeah. So it just sort of led me to, they were sort of private guys. I mean, you always sort of sense that even listening to them. I remember, you know, listening to them in the 50s, and it would be like a Friday show, and it had been advertised in newspapers or elsewhere that they were going to be on, like, say, the Perry Como show that Saturday or the Ed Sullivan show, and they'd never mention it. You know, other people would be beating it to death, but they just never did.
Yeah. I'd never thought about that, but I've never, in listening to the hundreds of hours that I've listened to Bob and Ray, I've never once heard them say, oh, and by the way, watch The Tonight Show this week because we're going to be on Friday night.
Yeah, they would never
I've never heard them do that.
Yeah, I asked Bob about that once. I mean, you wouldn't mention that. And he said, you know, it just sort of seemed like it would be pushy. You know?
Well, they also, and I'm trying to say this carefully, they don't seem like incredibly interesting people in their private lives. I mean, they just seemed like nice, normal guys who came to work. And so not necessarily, they don't have a scandal-ridden life that would a steamy biography.
No. They were really family guys, and when the show was over, they were out of there. There was no showbiz affectation about them either on or off the air. They were sort of, as I said in the book, they were sort of celebrity surrogates. They didn't hang with the Alan Kings or the Jack Carters or the Shecky Greens, although they admired them all. There were no sandwiches ever named after them at the Carnegie or Stage Delicatessens.
Well, that's wrong.
They were kind of like two introverts trapped in an extroverts business.
Yeah,
but I think that sort of lent an authenticity to their routines too, because it made it easier to believe in them.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody listening to a Bob and Ray show knows it's just that these are just sketches and they're meant to be funny, but because they were so real, there was no sense of theater about the guys, it was easier to suspend your disbelief.
Yeah, and there's also, this will sound like a left-handed compliment, but it's an actual compliment, that they didn't have enormous range in the voices they did. There's never any doubt that it's Ray or it's Bob. And there is a certain amount of, I mean, certainly Mary Magoon is not much like Calvin Hoogeveen, but they're also both clearly Ray. And and so it constantly reinforces the idea that it's these guys doing this sketch. I mean, they don't lose themselves in characters like some other more character-oriented people.
Well, I would say that to me it always seemed that what made the bits work was that once they were on the network, that in the middle of a bit, if you were totally into it, there was no Goulding or Elliot. That they did disappear into the characters. And when they had like four or five, you know, each with maybe, say, three or four characters in a room at the same time with, all those plates to keep spinning and keep remembering, you know, what each one's thought of the moment was, I thought you did lose track. You know, for me, it was for that moment it was real, and I was so used to the voices of the characters that I did You know, if I wanted, if you were to ask me to identify who's doing that voice or that voice, yes, I could do that. But I thought the range was pretty good. I mean, I thought, they both could do certain kind of voices. Ray's characters tended to be more outspoken, I think. You think of Captain Wolf Larson, that seething, ill-tempered pirate. Giddy women, as you pointed out, great at playing just delusional lost souls, uncontrollably laughing character of his, Charles the Poet.
Yes, the poet. Yeah.
Bob's characters, I think, tended to be tightly defined theatrical types. You know, bubbly MCs, stuff shirts. Ray did a lot of stuff shirts, too.
Sure.
Bob was Mr. Science, Wally Ballou, of course, the roving correspondent who showed up at every story he covered with both his adenoids and his ego.
Yeah.
Neither ever went into remission.
And he would either cause disaster wherever he was, or he would miss the actual story while talking to somebody else. The hallmark of Wally Ballou.
Yeah.
Except for being upcut by the engineer.
Yeah.
It's every once in a while he comes on and says his entire name, and it always disconcerts me.
I guess they were keeping it honest.
Yeah. They didn't do it all the time.
Yeah.
I've also always noticed Ray's voice, and toward the end, I guess he still was performing a little bit. I mean, he must have already been sick toward the end of their performing time, right?
Yeah, well, he was, you're alluding to the fact that kidney disease had run through his family, and he ultimately came down with it from age 56 on, really. Mm. He was on dialysis for 12 years, in fact. Mm. And it did take its toll. I mean, he remarked a couple of times that, sometimes he left the studio with his voice in a sling. But particularly doing the falsetto women's voices.
Kind of went away.
You do notice that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a tribute to how brilliant he was at doing that it doesn't necessarily bother you that much that the women suddenly just start...
That's true.
Talking a little bit closer to Bob's timber instead of the falsetto.
Ray's falsetto.
Excuse me, Ray.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think Harry Shearer, who I interviewed in this book, and I think he very correctly pointed out that they so believed in their characters, they just became them. You know, they fought like them.
Yeah.
And carried itself to the listener.
There are times, and getting back to the voice thing, I noticed especially in the Mary Backstage sketches when there are the two backstages, Calvin, Pop Beloved, and whoever else is in the, maybe Wolf Larson, and they'll all five or six or seven people will be talking to each other. And it's rapid fire, and they never miss who they're supposed to be. And it always kills me when somebody will say a word and they'll all repeat it just like that. I mean,
So
they say, you know, we're going to sink.
Yeah.
and it goes right around the table. And I think, they were incredibly gifted in that way. I mean, they never made a false step.
Yeah, when I would sit in the studio and watch him do that, I'd almost have to close my eyes to get that same, because it's just seeing these two guys sitting there doing that sort of came between the fiction and the reality.
And you notice they almost never have two of their own characters speak in succession.
Yeah, they instinctively, if one's talking, the other one will always be ready with another voice to come in.
I think they wanted a little bit of a buffer so that the ear could get used to Bob being somebody else.
Yeah. There is one episode of A Merry Backstage out there from when they were on WOR where Bob was out, I guess, ill on a given day, and Ray did the whole episode playing with his characters only, including filling in for Bob's announcer, Word Carr.
Yes. I don't think I've ever heard that episode. Now I must find it.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. When did you get to know Bob?
Well, forgetting when I would just go there to watch them, just when initially interviewing him for the book for the first time. And then in the years following, you know, the million phone calls and emails and so forth.
Was he living in New York when you first interviewed him, or had he already moved out?
He was always,
he's in New England somewhere now.
He is. Yeah. He was always living in Manhattan and had a summer place in Maine. And, so in the summers he would go up there, and then he was one of the, he was one of the few people who went to New York for the winter. You'd leave Maine and go into Manhattan, you know, around April of every year.
Now, was he in favor of a biography being written, or did he care
he
much
was.
One way?
Yeah, he was. He was, to my surprise, he was with it from the beginning. Very helpful and had great stories. All of the was just as candid about all of their successes and disappointments.
Now, I've never really done any research on radio. All my books have been about film, and so I know how to do that. But if I were to start researching a radio career, I'm not quite sure where I would start, except for the people themselves. But are there places where there are records? Are there station logs or
going back that far? Not really. I mean, if station logs exist, they're in warehouses in New Jersey somewhere, probably. Because I got onto them, I was hooked on Bob and Ray in the eighth grade. I sort of paralleled the time, so I mean, I just knew a lot of it in a very informal way. So I had a lot of answers going in, and then in interviewing Bob, he pointed me in various directions. I knew all the shows they had done. You know, I had listened to them. Yeah. You know, I couldn't hear the Boston shows. I was raised down here in Laguna Beach, California. But I heard all the network shows, and I remember watching their TV series. So I did have to go to some libraries and look up, you know, various. There's always some elusive fact you need, but
yeah, I guess the trades, variety and those
certainly
sort of things.
The weekly variety I used for a lot of reviews of their TV shows, but it was fairly easy because I at least knew when the shows were on and so forth.
The TV show was rebroadcast by whatever the Comedy Central was known as about 20 years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And I'd never seen them originally.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time I ever got a chance. And I was already, of course, a rabid Bob and Ray fan. Mm-hmm. But I never found the TV show quite caught fire. Did you?
No, it was, they were radio people. And the TV shows, you know, they both in later years, you know, made statements to the fact that those shows were just very, very on the fly and sort of sloppy. And but there was a spontaneity about it. And it was they were on the first, really, the year that the Honeymooners started, you know, I Love Lucy, 1951. So it was really TV when the foundation was being poured.
Yeah.
And totally live. And they weren't sponsored. and they didn't have musical numbers, so there was no, they or their announcer, a guy named Bob Denton, had to be on camera at every moment. There was no, you know, scenery changes. Everything had to be done on the fly. Costume changes, there would be a close-up of one of them while the other was running to the next set. You know.
But was there any room for improvisation on that show? Because I haven't seen it since I saw it then. Always struck me as being a little more structured.
Yes. Well, it had, because there had to be camera shots and so forth. As Gray Lockwood, who was one of the directors on the show, who I interviewed in the book, which, by the way, it's called Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons.
Which is a double takeoff on...
Yeah,
yes. Explain the title to...
You want me to explain the title?
Yeah.
Well, for years, one of the shows that they mocked was a detective series called Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons, that was on both CBS and NBC for years. And they just did their version of it. It was called Mr. Trace, Keener Than Most Persons.
Yeah.
Mr. Trace, Keener Than Most Persons. And ultimately that show went off. In fact, it was off for decades, and they were still doing the routine because, and this is true of just about all of their satires, you didn't have to know what the original was. It was just funny in and of itself. They used to do a series called Matt Neffer, Boy Spotwalder.
Yes.
And it all sort of centered around this one character, Matt Neffer, who was always angst-ridden about some crisis. Mm-hmm. And his sort of confounding inability to find himself in the same room at the same time.
Yes.
To have a conversation with his friend Todd. And that was primarily the whole bit. Nothing really ever happened.
Yes.
But I'm sure
listeners... I'm out on the veranda.
Yeah, had no idea, you know, what was what that was based on.
Yeah.
They did it forever.
Well, the Mr. Trace, Keener Than Most Persons, always ended up with the people entering this sort of labyrinth of words where they just start taking all the different words, trace, keen, so forth, and just making sentences in which all those things started mixing up. And that was how they always climaxed.
Yes, they did do that sometimes. Often they took place in the penthouse apartment of some very rich person, just like the real series.
Mm-hmm.
And the episodes all had, they would always say, today the surly old investigator takes from his files the case he calls the hiccuping tragedians or whatever it would be. But the real satire that they were doing specifically that related to the original was clumsy exposition. Lines like, you there, trying to hide behind that curtain with your feet sticking out, because it was radio. These shows had to resort to that, and there was no greater offender of it.
Why are you pointing that gun at me?
Yes,
no,
exactly.
Don't shoot.
Oh,
you shot me.
Yes.
I've been murdered.
Yes,
you have killed me.
Exactly. Yeah, and they, the original series, Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Person, was the biggest offender of that.
Yeah.
And that was the initial core of the satire. And it was always ad-libbed. Yeah. And later they had writers and they had other written bits, but you had asked me another question, which I now have forgotten, but
yes.
We got off track
a little bit.
Yeah.
But we talked about your book, so that's the important thing. So.
Sure.
Now getting back to the issue of writers, I must admit I didn't know this until maybe 3 or 4 years ago that they ever had any writers. And it kind of broke my heart for a little bit. I've tried to come to terms with it, but but I've always thought of them so much as an entity standing by themselves. Tell me, how many writers did they have? And Tell me a little bit how they worked with them.
Well, the interesting thing is they really didn't work with the writers. The writers wrote it and brought the stuff in, and they more or less did it. But, you know, when they got to the network, they were doing, they did a 15-minute show every day at 5:45. They did an hour show on Saturday. And then when they added the TV series, that was a quarter hour every day. And then at a given point that very first summer, they started in July, and by late August, they were doing the early morning show on WNBC, just locally in New York. It was just so much airtime. They had to have writers. So the initial writer they got was somebody named Ray Knight, who had been a big NBC star way back in the 30s, mm-hmm. and both had been fans of them. And it just so happened that Ray Knight, who had a show called The Cuckoo's Hour, the Cuckoo Hour, back all through the 1930s, and a fellow who initially brought them to New York, an NBC executive called I'm blanking his name at the moment, Bud Berry, Charles C. Bud Berry, had been there then, so he knew of Ray Knight, and he just thought it would be a perfect match, because Ray Knight's show, The Cuckoo Hour, was really the first satirist of broadcasting, and that's what, you know, every bit Bob and Ray ever did at one level or another was making fun of broadcasting. It was their subject matter. True. And it was their medium, and so he thought that was a good match, and it turned out to be. He added more structure to the bits, you know, he Ray Knight, that is. He sort of got with their sensibility. And it was a very good marriage, and a lot of very funny bits that they did, he wrote. As to breaking your heart, I mean, that's a shame. But you also know everybody had writers.
Well, sure.
I mean, Jack Benny, they had teams of writers. So there was no, there was never a stigma about that or anything.
No.
And
it's just that I've always thought of them as improvisers. And
well, but they kept doing their regular bits too, the soap operas, the Linda Lovelies that you mentioned, the Mary Backstages, which was based on another old time mm-hmm. Mary Noble backstage wife. They always continued to ad lib those. There were the ad lib bits and there were the written bits, and that sort of continued. The other, Mr. Trace, as I mentioned, was always ad-lib. Charles the Poet was always ad-lib. The Matt Neffer, Boy Spot Welder, chatter with the characters was always spontaneous. But there would be these.
One Fellow's Family is always struck as being.
Yeah, that was always ad-lib. Yeah. Ray Knight died suddenly, at a very early age. I think he was only 54. And so then they had a succession of writers, and in the book I do list them all. And then ultimately they hooked up with Tom Cook, and he wrote some very funny things. He came up with routines that could be repeated episodically, like Mr. Science and a lot of the Wally Ballou remotes he wrote, and Biff Burns.
Tippy the Wonder Dog, did he do those?
Yes, he did that later. Yeah, that came in much later. He did Squad Car 119, which mm-hmm. is a Dragnet spoof. I guess the most, arguably the most enduring, and one that he did the most of, was called The Gathering Dusk.
Mm.
And it was really just it was a soap spoof, not based on any one show, but based on a spinster aunt he had, who was this sort of paranoid character who just sat in her home imagining all of these terrible things. And Bob said that, you know, when his material, and Tom wrote from the West Coast, and they were always in New York. And Bob said, you know, when his envelopes, when Tom's envelopes of material would arrive, he and Ray would always rip it open just to see, you know, what calamity was going to be befall this character named Edna Bessinger. Mm. Another big soap he wrote was called Bridget Hillary and the News.
Oh, yes.
Which was based on a real CBS soap opera called Wendy Warren and the News, which actually had a legitimate newscast with Douglas Edwards in the middle of it. It was on every day for years.
Wow. So they would have plot of the show, and then there would be real news, and then they would go back to
the real news would sort of come at the very beginning, as I recall it, and then they would go into the it went on for many years.
The Gathering Dusk was one of those things that commented on itself early on, and then they stopped doing it because in the first many episodes, they'd get to the very end, and she would say, "I almost feel as though I'm no longer standing in." And then Bob would say, "Turn the page, turn the page." The Gathering Dusk.
Yeah.
And they did that a long time. Turn the page. We're doing
they would do that. Yeah. But you're right. The standard ending for that was "I'm no longer standing in the gap." They did it on every series that Tom worked on. If Tom wasn't like the series on CBS was written by Tom was doing the George Gobel show, I think then. So they had another writer named Phil Green. So, you know, Phil Green's not going to write Tom Cook's material. So they couldn't do it there, but they did it all through the NPR series too.
Sure. Well, the NPR series always struck me as being much more structured and the wordplay much more precise, so it's clearly written almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Almost everything there. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can...
You're right. No, you're right, because Tom also wrote the that funny serial they did on all those shows called... do you remember, Frank, the name... forgets me. It was based on all those shows at the time, Falcon Crest and Dallas.
Gary Summit.
Yes, Gary Summit. Yeah,
because all those things had these very elaborate, I mean, even the setup of Gary Summit, you know, looking down on the squalid village below.
And, yes, that was it, yeah. Tom wrote those, and those had live organ music cues, so those they had to, like, sort of run through those and, you know, everyone had to be on the same page there, obviously.
Yeah, I enjoy those, but they're much... It's really interesting to go back to how we started this conversation, to listen to those NPR shows and then to listen to a 1949 WHDH show.
Yes.
It's almost like they're completely different people. Of course, 40 years have...
Totally agree. Agree. Yeah, mm-hmm. each series had its own kind of... you know, for me, I always thought the series they did on Mutual from 1955 to 57, which was 45 minutes every late afternoon around 5 o'clock, was the funniest. I mean, it had the combination of everything you're mentioning, the ad-lib routines. They ad-libbed a Linda Lovely every single day there. It had some of Tom's stuff, and they had the time to play around. They played with like a few records during it and read live commercials, and that was the 45 minutes was the longest network show, well, I guess with the exception of the initial NBC weekend show Inside Bob and Ray. Those were an hour.
Now, they never really made much of an impact in movies. Was it something they just weren't particularly interested in pursuing? I remember Cold Turkey being It was a really interesting, funny film and dark, dark film.
Yeah, yeah.
But they play essentially Huntley and Brinkley and beautifully. I mean, so they really could have done a lot more of that sort of thing. But I'm wondering if it was a choice or if they just didn't get the opportunities.
My guess would be the latter. They, they... I don't know that they turned down any movie parts. I think they like doing those, and they like working with Norman Lear on Cold Turkey. They did the subsequent movie Author, Author, where they played the backers of a play by a young playwright played by Al Pacino. Subsequently, Bob by himself played a bank guard in a movie with Bill Murray called Quick Change.
Yes, I just saw that very recently.
Yeah, and they were there. They were at the mercy of the screenplay. You know, they were hired actors. They came in, played their parts, and Norman Lear. When I talked to Norman Lear for the book, he said, you know, I think from the beginning, I always saw Bob and Ray playing all these newscasters for Cold Turkey.
Yeah, because they'd done it so much, I mean, that sort of thing was was exactly what they were up to.
Yeah.
After Ray's death, it seemed like Bob didn't slow down at all, and he shows up on TV. I mean, he's in his son Chris's show, Got a Life.
Which
is one of my favorite TV shows.
Yeah, that's a great premise.
Yeah.
Great premise for a series.
And it's a perfect role for Bob.
Yes. Yeah. Play the whole series, you know, wearing a bathrobe, you know, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it. It was Chris played a 35-year-old paperboy still living at home in his parents' house in a little, small little apartment above the garage. And, Ray played, Bob, of course, played his father.
And Eleanor Donoghue played his mother.
Yes.
And in every scene, they're just sitting in the kitchen in their bathrobes. Mm-hmm. And to my knowledge, only what I think is the classic episode, Zoo Animals on Wheels, do they get dressed and go out because they have to go see him in this play, which they'd rather do anything than do. But when Bob says, is it scientifically possible to die of embarrassment? So.
Yeah. And Bob, I guess later in an episode on the Bob Newhart show, played Bob's father.
Yeah. Yeah. They would show up now and again on sitcoms and just be.
Yes. Yes. They did another. And there was another sitcom with Phyllis. The actress who was married to Adolph Green, Phyllis Newman. Phyllis Newman and Alan Young had a series about a retirement home in Arizona. Coming of Age, it was called.
I don't remember that at all.
And Bob and Ray played, I guess, they wore military uniforms, as I recall, and I think they were the head of the homeowners association, but I could be wrong on that. It's in the book, but that was one of the last TV appearances they made. They made a million variety show appearances.
Sure.
They were on every, you know, the Perry Como, Ed Sullivan. I believe they were on about five times. They did Flip Wilson's show. They were on the Tonight Show all through the Steve Allen, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson eras. They were on the 12:30 show with David Letterman many times.
You can find some of those Letterman clips on YouTube these days.
Yeah, same with the Carson ones.
Are there some Carsons?
Yeah.
Because I periodically go to YouTube and just type in Bob and Ray and see what comes up. And every once in a while, there'll be something that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
But it's always interesting to me, especially on the Letterman show, because Letterman idolized them.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I remember one time.
In fact, he wrote the foreword.
Yeah,
for the book.
Wrote the foreword to your book, as he well should have. I remember one time he introduced them by saying, you know, if I ever find that somebody doesn't like Bob and Ray, I find that I don't like them very much or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, I remember and, that. In fact, in a couple of drafts, I think that line is in the book. In fact, he said, when you were young in college, if you're never sure about somebody, if they like Bob and Ray, they're okay.
Yep. I think that.
And I think it might even have pertained to, you know, dating. And if you meet a woman and she likes Bob and Ray, they're okay. But of course, their big theorem, maybe I'm jumping ahead of your questions here, but I think if you're talking about movies, the thing that they really thought was a, I guess the nerviest thing they did was their Broadway show.
Yes. Bob and Ray, the Two and Only?
Bob and Ray, the Two and Only, which ran for about 6 months on Broadway and then toured for a year.
Yeah, that it always surprised me because I've heard the recording of it, of course. Mm-hmm. I listen to it a lot, in fact.
Yeah.
Because it really is kind of a best of Bob and Ray in a way. It has a lot of the classic.
It has a lot of bits that ultimately became classics. It's certainly right about that. But a lot of their classic stuff, they really couldn't do. It just didn't translate to a one-on-one audience sitting there in front of them. So it took a long time going through and selecting the material and figuring out which ones. And because a lot of the bits, as we've been saying, were ad-libbed, they had to transcribe them onto paper first. And so as Ray points out, that they had to memorize what they had originally ad-libbed.
Having never seen it, did you see it?
Yeah, I did see it.
Well, good. You can answer this then.
Sure.
of course, it's in your book. I'm pretending I haven't read your book for the purposes of this conversation. I'd always been curious about how much they acted out what they did, because I thought, well, if it was just the two of them just sitting there on stage for 2 hours, that might start to get tedious, maybe.
Yeah.
So they had to...
Oh, yeah, it had to be, it couldn't be a static recitation of material. It had to be an evening in the theater, and that's exactly what it had. It had scenery, it had exits and entrances, and to use your words, they acted it. Yeah, it was very convincing. It got screams, it got raves. Yeah. I mean, the reviews, they couldn't have anticipated reviews like that.
Well, on some of the shows or some of the sketches I've seen them do, like Slow Talkers, watching them do it is a very different experience than listening to it by themselves of Ray's agitation.
Yes.
He's actually, he's shaking. His knees are going up and down. He's just.
Yeah.
So he's.
Yeah.
Yes. And that you don't get it. I mean, you get his frustration just with.
You hear it in the voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hear the. The frustration in his voice. Yeah, well, I interviewed at length one of the co-producer of the show, Jana Levine, and she said when they hit upon this device, which Bob credits the director, Joseph Hardy, with coming up with, in the middle of the Slow Talker, the intermission, the end of the first act is the Slow Talker.
Mm.
And Ray is, as you point out, dying with these interminable answers and the spaces between the words going on forever. And finally, ultimately, the curtain just comes down on it. And that's the intermission. And the audience comes back 15 minutes later, the curtain goes up, and he's still talking. And that just got screams. And Jana said that, the form of the whole thing took off, when they hit upon that during the rehearsals.
That would be great. That would be great. I still regret that I was never able to see them perform because I would love to have.
On the road, they never really did it here in Los Angeles. I think it's the closest they got was at Palo Alto at Stanford University.
Hmm.
But they toured all over. You know.
I wonder why not Los Angeles?
I don't know why that was. But they were in the Ford's Theater in Washington and Philadelphia and Cincinnati and Toronto, Florida.
Wow. Amazing. When's the last time you talked with Bob?
Yesterday.
Wow. Did you give him my regards? He's doing well, I hope.
Yeah, he just had he sat in a bookstore in Maine autographing books.
Wow.
This is a tiny little store in a little town in Maine, and they sold like 80 books, you know, starting just at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing well.
Yeah, I would have gone to Maine had I known such a thing was happening.
You would have enjoyed it.
Yes. I got one letter from him one time. I just was wondering about something. It was in when the backstages are doing Furioso. What's it?
Westchester Furioso, yes. Run on the backstages.
Yeah, and this was several years ago, and I kept listening to that, and the music that was playing had clearly been recorded for something else.
Yes.
And I didn't know what. So I wrote to Larry Josephson, who runs the Bob and Ray website, and I said, "Do you know what this is?" And he said, "I don't know. Why don't you write to Bob and ask him?" And I said, "What? You can do that?"
Yeah, something in your hat.
Or yeah, it's from the New Voices of 1953. And it's...
New Faces?
New Faces, excuse me. Boy. I told you I'd never edit this thing. I'll edit that out. It was Paul Lynde singing In Your Hat by... Something...
Yeah. Well, they used...
Lily Bichet.
Who?
It's the whole name, as Bob corrected me in the letter he wrote back, it said, it's called In Your Hat by Lily...
Lily Deshaies was a big hat man, a big and, hat maker in Manhattan.
But he wrote me a nice long letter in response, and most important, sent it on that incredibly hilarious stationery he has.
Yeah,
and so that's one of the treasures of my life.
Yeah, that was great stationery, and we figured a way to get a sample of it in the book. In fact,
yes,
you probably noticed.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, what Frank is referring to is listing all their characters under the board of directors.
Yeah,
along the left-hand margin.
Yes, it's like an industrial kind of stationery.
But, yeah.
For this company they have. You were talking about Norman Lear a while ago that you interviewed him for the book, and you'd worked with Norman Lear. We should talk a little bit about your own career as a writer, because you worked on major, major stuff. All in the Family.
Yeah.
Mary Tyler Moore. MASH.
Right, right.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you were on the staff on the very last episode of MASH.
Yeah,
one of the highest rated programs in TV history.
Yeah, yeah. We've always been proud of that. The final episode of MASH, which was actually a 2.5-hour movie, got a 77% share of the audience.
I don't think that's even possible.
Yes,
now.
Well, it certainly isn't possible today, because the audience with cable so pervasive now, it's you could never come up with percentages like that. But yeah, my writing partner, Elias Davis, and I were on MASH for the last three seasons. So that was a fun thing to be a part of. We enjoyed that.
I always liked MASH, and how much direction were you given when you were writing those things in terms of, because it seemed especially toward the end that it seemed to become a much more serious show as time went on. I mean, it seemed to be a little bit more message-driven. Might be the wrong way to put it, but it seemed to be a little bit more about serious things, which was always an element of the show. But it seemed to me that toward the end, it really became much more so. Was that something you guys were aware of, or am I wrong?
Well, I don't know that we were ever aware of sending messages. I mean, somebody was interviewing me and sort of asked that question, too, about All in the Family. You know, they said, well, how much of it was, you know, how much did you have to study the newspaper every day to get across, you know, a political message or, you know, or some social message? And, you know, I'm sure any writer who wrote that show never thought that way. And similarly on MASH, I mean, always you try to make it entertaining and funny. I mean, that's always the when you think of the stories, you try to make them both dramatic and funny, and that's always number one. There's an old cliche in the business about if you want to send a message, go to Western Union. But I can't. But I do know that. Certainly the first 4 years, Larry Gelbart, when he was there, they did have a very distinct kind of Larry Gelbart black humor to them. And maybe that's what you're referring to. I mean, you know, jokes written by Larry Gelbart were just, you know, in a league of their own. No, I can't say we tried to avoid being pedantic or, you know, trying to get messages across. Everyone knew, you know, certainly the series paralleled the Vietnam War and perhaps lingered a few years after. Well, actually didn't, though, I guess, maybe. Though it did, because the series went off in the early 80s. So there was always that sort of pervasive feeling that we were sort of talking about Korea, but there was always the Vietnamese, sure. The Vietnam implication to it, you know. But no, I don't think we ever tried to.
Now, for these other shows, like Mary Tyler Moore Show, mm-hmm. Did you just do individual scripts, or were you on staff for?
Yeah, the former. We just did those on a freelance basis, and we were not on the staff. We ultimately were hired on the staff of MTM, but on the Paul Sands show, which was running parallel with the Mary Tyler Moore show.
I remember that show fondly. Paul Sands is one of those guys who strikes me as. Never having gotten the career that he deserved, at least on TV. He was such a great stage actor and comic.
Yeah, he was always very well, very much appreciated, yeah. I know, in the business.
Really talented guy.
A very talented guy, yeah. Yeah, and very, very a very unique performer.
And I was looking at a list of your credits and saw that you were on a show that I hadn't thought of in years, but remember liking called... A Touch of Grace? Is it called A Touch of Grace? It was the Shirley Booth.
Yeah, we did.
And Pat O'Malley.
You're right. Yeah. A Touch of Grace. I think we did that around 1971 or two. It was on ABC. It was based on previous to that, Elias Davis and I had been working on a series in London, and we had seen what was the catalyst for A Touch of Grace. It was based on a British series called The Loves of Ada. And it was just about, a somewhat elderly woman who has a relationship with a, if I remember this, I mean, it's amazing when the series end, you know, they sort of jump out of your memory. But with a grave digger, you know, he dug graves in a cemetery. So that was the basis of that fun series.
Well, I don't remember it well at all, but I just remember the feeling of it and remember that it was kind of a gentle, underplayed.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't remember it being all that successful here. I don't think it ran, you know, maybe a year or two. At the longest.
I think, I can't think that it went over a season, but it might have.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. You really caught me by surprise on that one.
I go deep on these things.
Yeah.
But I'm about to let you out of the shallow end. We should wrap it up pretty soon.
Okay.
So thank you very much. Your book is really terrific. I recommend it to anybody, and especially Bob and Ray lovers like me. It really tells the story, and it's beautifully done.
Great. Thank you, Frank. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David Pollack. I had a really good time, and man, I still regret that I didn't know about that book signing in Maine. To think that there are people out there with those pens that say, write if you get work on them, and I don't have one. I want one. I need one. I deserve one. I want to thank all the usual crew for their help in making this podcast possible. In addition to my guest, David Pollack, I want to thank my wonderful announcer, Claire McCullough, my bride. As a matter of fact, we celebrated our 20th anniversary just 2 weeks ago on June 20th. So that makes it extra special to hear her dulcet tones. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll go to each one, but I particularly hope that you'll go to thecommentarytrack.com and order a copy of my new DVD, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. Yes, it's finally available, and I hope that you will go there and buy one, and then buy several, and then buy hundreds, and perhaps buy thousands. Surely there's at least one person listening here who would like to buy thousands of copies of my DVD. Surely that's the case. Of course, I also want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for providing my great music. And for those of you who buy the DVD of The Lost Remake of Beaugest, you will hear Rob Clearfield's music there. And it's lovely stuff it is, too. So, please order the DVD. And in the meantime, you can watch that while you're waiting for the next episode of The Commentary Track, which will actually be 2 weeks from now, because next weekend, when I should be posting my podcast, I'll be in San Francisco for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. And I have lots of interviews lined up there. I think I have 8 scheduled so far. So there will be many episodes of The Commentary Track that will be recorded that week. And I hope I'll have some time to see some silent films while I'm there, because there's a really terrific lineup of films. And I'd like to see all of them. So we'll see how that works out. But anyway, we'll see you the week after that, when my guest will be John Tibbetts, one of the most prolific writers and film historians and scholars that I've ever known, and also a very, very close friend of mine. And I think you should look forward to that, because it's a fun, fun talk. Thanks a lot for listening. See you next time, and don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.